Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I am pleased to welcome back for either the fourth or fifth time. I can't remember how many times it's been, but Tom Hischak is here. Hi, Tom.
Morning.
Good morning. You are here because you have a brand new book called Bringing Song and Dance to the Screen, Directors of Golden Age Hollywood Musicals. The last time Tom was here was back in August of 2024 with his wonderful book, Song of the Season, which was really fascinating as he looked at each Broadway season and picked the most significant or most long-lasting or most important show tune from each season, which was a very interesting exercise that he had to go through. And I highly recommend you seek out that book because it's a real, real wonderful one to add to your collection of theater books. But we are going to delve into Hollywood musicals, which is a little bit, might be a little bit different for a Broadway radio show, but not so much in the sense that a lot of the musicals that we will talk about and many of the directors we will talk about or that are covered in the book are right from the East Coast and moved to the West Coast because a lot of them got their start on Broadway, whether as actors or choreographers or even directors, and moved to Hollywood when Hollywood shifted to making musicals with the advent of sound. And many of the musicals that they were making were adaptations of Broadway musicals. So there is definitely a connection to Broadway musicals. So the book covers musicals from, I think you begin with Jazz Singer and you get all the way up to Gigi. So it's basically three decades worth of Broadway movie musicals in the great Hollywood studio system. And it covers 27 different directors, which we will kind of jump into and kind of discuss the whole concept of how these different directors were assigned to musicals and their backgrounds and why some of them didn't seem to be the kind of guys who would be directing musicals, but did. But first off, how did this book come about? And how did you get interested in doing this book?
I love Hollywood musicals, mm-hmm. and particularly the Golden Age. And the Golden Age is, 27, the Jazz Singer to Gigi. Not that wonderful musicals haven't come out since then, but that is the Golden Age because it also it parallels the studio system. Mm-hmm. They could crank out these musicals every year. Each studio would turn out at least six or seven, and A movies and B movies. And they had this factory system. They had their orchestrators, they had their own orchestra, they had their vocal coaches, music arrangers, choreographers. The whole factory was there to create musicals, and they could do them in a way that we can't do them today. So that's why it's a golden age. Mm-hmm. And of all the people that get the attention, it's a Judy Garland movie, or it's a Gene Kelly movie. The stars get the most attention. The songs, secondly, it's an Irving Berlin musical. But very rarely does anybody mention the director. Mm-hmm. Few cases people say it's a Vincent Minnelli film.
Right. I was going to say Minnelli.
That's a case. And then when Gene Kelly turned to directing, it was a Kelly and Stanley Donen film, maybe. Mm-hmm. But most, or a Busby Berkeley film earlier, because he had such a, put such a mark on his musicals. But basically, these guys, and they are all men, I'm afraid to say, women were directing, but not musicals. And they just have not been looked at. They've been looked at as directors of other things. Mm-hmm. But what about their career directing musicals? I thought that was an interesting idea for a book. Mm-hmm. You take someone like Irving Cummings, who directed like 100 musicals, and 20 of them were, 100 films, 20 of them were musicals. And it's like, well, this is important. What did he bring to it? And it seems to me when you have a huge studio musical and you got all these people, what does the director do to show his mark? Music is chosen, the sets and everything. And what did the director do? Is what it came down to me. Mm-hmm. What did Mark Sandrich do in those Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies? I mean, you know, he must have done a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They have a look, they have a feel, they have a kind of a charm to them, and which is different when other people directed Fred Astaire or Ginger Rogers in another movie. So that was my goal, is look at these guys during the Golden Age, when the musicals were the best, and try to figure out, look at their careers, and try to figure out what did they do by looking mm-hmm. at just their musicals.
Right. And I was going to say, how did you, because there were a lot of directors. If you go, like, as you said, it was the middle of the studio system. So there were some freelance directors who bounced around and worked independently. But for the most part, you mm-hmm. had these kind of what I would consider like these studio workhorse directors who were under contract to the studios. MGM had their whole roster of directors. 20th Century Fox did, Paramount did, and they were under contract, and they handled whatever assignments they were given for the most part. And they handled comedies and dramas and historical epics, and they handled musicals. Yeah. They were handled whatever we were given. Yeah. So they had to be very flexible, very versatile. So how did you, and there were hundreds of them, hundreds of directors over the entire industry. So how did you come up with your 27? Because was it a matter of kind of looking at each studio and saying, okay, what were the musical output and who were the major directors doing musicals at those points?
Mm-hmm. I did it statistically. I looked mm-hmm. at who directed the most musicals.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at that list, and it was, you know, that was a short list. And then I went down who directed just, and then one or two, who directed only one musical, but it's a classic.
Yeah. You know?
James Whaley,
yeah,
announced that way, directs Frankenstein, you know, and that's a classic. And then he directs Showboat.
Right.
And it's one of the most amazing things. And it's the only musical he ever did. Mm-hmm. And he was very proud of it, I understand. That
mm-hmm.
his life, he didn't want to be remembered for Frankenstein. He wanted to be remembered for Showboat.
Right.
Never going to happen.
Well, because he got labeled kind of, you know, doing the Universal horror movies. Yeah.
And
he did the horror movies.
Where they made those great horror movies. So I started with the ones of the busiest. And then I looked at, wow, there's George Stevens, one of the great mm-hmm. directors. And he only directed two, I believe. But boy, those two are good. So it wasn't just the most busy, the popular.
Right. Right.
Exactly. You know, and I had the list of about 100, you know, mm-hmm. and that whittled it down all the way to these handful.
Right.
I thought they were the most interesting, significant. Mm-hmm. And they were doing A movies, you know, just think of all the directors who directed the B musicals, you
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
And never graduated, you know, up into the next level.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the people came from, and they were different.
Yeah, and they were.
I looked at how their movies were different.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were working with and what people, if any listeners are not familiar with this particular period, the musicals generated during the Golden Age by these different studios were all very different because, one, they were created during different time periods because 1930s musicals tended to be different than the 1940s musicals. Yeah. And each studio kind of did their own types of musicals in a sense. Right. Like the Warner Brothers musicals of the 1930s were like the Busby Berkeley backstage musicals. And you had Fox doing the Shirley Temple musicals. Mm-hmm. And you had MGM doing the Nelson Eddy, Jeanette McDonald operettas. And, and then you get to the 40s and you've got 20th Century Fox doing their crazy Carmen Miranda, Alice Faye, mm-hmm. Don Ameche, South American musicals. And everybody had their own kind of niche when it came to what type and style of musicals that they were doing. I mean, and in between there were the standard, you know, typical musical comedy, romantic musicals, but they all kind of had their own stamp, and it required the directors at those studios to kind of fit into the niche that the studio itself, the gigantic studio complex, had created for themselves. Right.
There was a look to each studio at times. The Warner Brothers as you say, in the 30s, the Depression musicals, we call them, mm-hmm. you know, the Gold Diggers and all that for Second Street, they got a kind of a grainy, tough, almost a film noir look to them, you know.
Right. Well, they were doing gangster pictures too at the same time.
You know, and it's, you know, there was dark aspects to it. On the other hand, MGM was glossy,
mm-hmm.
Especially once they've come into color.
Right. Know?
And there was a glossiness to their movies. There was a different kind of color to the 20th Century Fox.
Mm-hmm.
They were color movies, but they didn't look like MGM, you know?
Right, right. There was the Fox Technicolor was totally different. They had a different...
And then one of my favorites was the RKO Art Deco movies mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a coincidence that all their musicals had this very sleek, black and white Art Deco design. Mm-hmm. And they were all designed by the same people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And I tried to find out when a director went into a project, how much say they had in the musical. Was it already all set up? These are the sets. These are the star. This is the song. These are the songs. And you start on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Or were they involved while they were writing it and because they knew they were going to direct it? We know this happens later on with people like Vincent Minnelli, very much into the creation of his movies, you know, mm-hmm. about the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And the decisions, he's there for the big decisions. He didn't always get his choice. He didn't win all the time, but he was there at least to argue, oh, I want to go to Paris for this. Oh, I want this person. You know, oh, I want that. So how much they were involved in the putting it together is not quite clear to me. Even the biographies, the autobiographies, they don't really go into, you know, mm-hmm. that aspect of it. We know the writers are knocking their heads together trying to come up with a plot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The songwriters are usually working separately. It's like, while they figure out the plot, we'll write the songs, you know.
Right.
And they'll fit. But so these directors, you think, well, if they just kind of came in and directed them, how come they have a similarity to them? Is it the directors or is it the studio just... Cranky.
Right, the studio stamp, which is the look and the feel. The cinematographers are the same because they're all under contract. But at the same time, there is in the early 30s, especially you've got someone like Ernst Lubitsch who's doing musicals, which he definitely has a touch and control over some of those early musicals he was doing at Paramount. Mamoulian also, I think, had some control over his stuff because of his stage career.
Yep.
But you're right. I mean, I think it's very limited in terms of when it comes right to the studios but I think really what works, we should dive into, because I picked like three of the directors from the book to mm-hmm. chat about, to kind of get a feel for the different types of directors and who they were. And some of the, I tried to pick people that may not be familiar to listeners.
Because you've got names.
Yeah. I mean, I know who they are because I'm a big film buff.
Right.
But I didn't want to pick like George Cukor or people like that who people are going to be familiar with, sort of. But I wanted to pick people, some of these directors, I think they're what they lent was the fact that they could work well with certain stars.
Right.
And that also helps with the performances of the performers, because they are very comfortable working with certain performers mm-hmm. and they can get the best out of them, which makes those musicals better because you have someone who's very comfortable and at ease with the director they're working with. And I think that sort of holds true with the first person we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about W.S. Van Dyke, Woody Van Dyke, because he was at MGM. And he did 9 musicals while he was there, but he was probably better known for a lot of people for his other movies, because he did like The Thin Man Thin Man movies with Myrna Loy and William Powell. He did San Francisco. He did Marie Antoinette. He did big epics. He did all sorts of things. And he was at MGM for ages under contract with MGM for ages, but he was known, his nickname around the lot was One Take Woody, because he was efficient and fast, and he brought movies in on or under budget all the time. He moved quickly, but he got along with the big names on the lot, like Clark Gable and Spencer Tracy, and particularly with Jeanette MacDonald,
right,
who was doing, you know, operetta work at MGM at the time, and ended up working with her on a lot of musicals, which was not necessarily something I think people associate W.S. Van Dyke with, but yeah. talk about his work with her at MGM.
Yeah, he did direct close to 100 movies.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly prolific, starting in The Silence and whatnot.
Yeah,
and he was guaranteed. I should say he guaranteed that a movie would be finished on time.
Mm-hmm.
Now they wanted that in everybody.
Right.
And if you look at anyone who directed in Hollywood, a lot of movies, and you look at the careers, and you'll find out it's because they were efficient in the studio. Mm-hmm. You know, you had the Vincent Minnellis who went over budget, over time, and everything, and they don't have as many movies.
Mm-hmm.
They still got plenty, but you didn't rush to him. Woody, one take Woody was a guarantee. You know, especially if it was a big, complicated movie. You mentioned San Francisco. I mean, mm-hmm. this is like a Gone with the Wind epic. It's a huge mm-hmm. movie, a lot of characters, and just filled at the end with special effects for the earthquake. This, you put Woody Van Dyke in there because this thing could run over and just, you know,
mm-hmm.
just cost over so much money. But he was known. Some actors didn't like him because they wouldn't do a second take.
Yeah,
they were not method, but if they were all like, you know, oh, I think I could do it better, and it's like, cut, take it, you know, set up the next one. We got to move on. But a lot of people did like him. And Jeanette MacDonald must have trusted him because he led her through some very tricky musicals. I think the daring one at the time was to do a musical version of Naughty Marietta.
Mm-hmm.
This was in 1935. That musical was already old-fashioned. It goes back to 1910.
Uh-huh.
And nobody was going to operettas. They died during the Depression.
Uh-huh.
And but the studio wanted to do it, and Jeanette MacDonald was their leading soprano, and they wanted Alan Jones. He was their leading man, beautiful voice, you know, handsome.
Uh-huh.
But he was either booked or another studio. No, I don't think so. It was just he couldn't do it. So they needed somebody to match. And they found Nelson Eddy. He wasn't an actor. He was a radio singer. And of course, if you've seen him, you could believe
right.
he was a radio singer and not an actor.
Right.
He
got better over time.
He did.
By
the time they did Sweethearts, Van Dyke got a really lively performance out of this, you know, wooden guy. So Naughty Marietta was a surprise hit.
Mm-hmm.
Audiences loved it. And of course, everybody jumped on the bandwagon. And in the 30s, we have wonderful operetta movies where on Broadway, they weren't doing them anymore because the Depression mm-hmm. pretty much killed them off. So, he got her through Naughty Marietta. The script is ridiculous in the original, and they came up with an almost as ridiculous script, but that wasn't what operettas were about. And the audiences fell in love with these two. It's just something about the chemistry or the vocal harmony of these two voices. And I think they did six movies together, and Van Dyke directed at least three or four of them.
Oh, at last I found thee. I know at last the secret of it all the longing, seeking, striving, waiting, yearning, the idle hopes, the joy and burning tears that fall. For it is love and love alone the world is seeking. And it is love and love alone I've waited for. And my heart has heard the answer to it.
What Van Dyke was able to do, staying in the studio, he was able to make his movies look like they were outside.
Mm-hmm.
Rosemary is a good example. Rosemary mm-hmm. has very few interiors. It's in the Canadian mountains, the Rockies. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's beautiful lakes and everything. And it's all screen stuff behind them. But it feels expansive. It feels mm-hmm. like it's not a Broadway operetta. It feels like a movie. And he was able to do that. And some of it's a little clumsy. The technology is not that great. But like in Rosemary, the two of them sitting, you know, going in a canoe in a lake or sitting on the shore and singing, you know, the Indian love call and listening to the echo. It was kind of revealing that, wow, these old operettas, they're very romantic, you know, if they have a romantic setting. So, yeah, he stuck with the two of them. Yeah, she was even in San Francisco, wasn't she? Yeah.
Yeah.
McDonald was the lead in that one, too, where that was Clark Gable and Spencer Tracy were her co-stars. But Van Dyke could do that. And being efficient, he didn't want to go on location. The studios hated it when you went on location, mm-hmm. unless you're making a Western.
Right.
You know? Get right. in the boots, go outside of town 10 miles, you know, in mm-hmm. the desert, make the Western, but say, oh, I want to film it in Nebraska, you mm-hmm. know, or God forbid, Paris. You know.
Mm-hmm.
They said, no. Even if you go outside, they had their exterior sets. You know, their main street or their city street. But even then you had to worry about the weather, which wasn't a big deal in California. Mm-hmm. It was pretty standard. But in a studio, you had complete control. And I think that's what Van Dyke loved, is he can control every sound, everything you see, you know, and do it efficiently. He must have planned ahead of time. Because these shots, you know, sometimes they set up a whole day setting up a shot. He knew what he wanted. They set it up and that's it. He didn't say, let's take it from a, you know, different angles. Let's not do another master, you know. So he did plan and he did know where he wanted to put the camera. So when they went in the studio, they didn't waste time like that. Most of your time in a studio, even today, is standing around waiting.
Right.
Exactly. 90% of the time, actors standing around, just standing around, you know, oh, we're trying to get the lights right. We're trying to get this right. It's an amazing that you get wonderful performances because just doing that saps your energy, just sitting around. You know, that my only experience was being an extra in a movie for a couple of days. And it was like, oh, my God, actors. You know, oh, God, 2 hours later, let's do the next four lines, you know? It's, especially coming from theater. It
just, yes.
It wasn't a good example.
Yes.
The best explanation I had, I'm a theater person, it was Chris Ashley, the director, who's, you know, very hot right now. And he was talking to some of my students in a group thing. And he said, what about movies? You know, because he was talking about theater. And he said, making a movie is like a tech rehearsal every day.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no character rehearsals.
Right.
There's no blocking rehearsals. It's always tech.
Right.
So anyway, we got off the subject. But Van Dyke must have been very efficient within a studio setting because his movies don't look like they're inside. Naughty Marietta is a lot of exteriors. San Francisco, my God, you know, you got the city streets collapsing all around you. Rosemary set in the mountains, just beautiful. Yeah, he must have done his homework,
right?
I wanted
to pick him to talk about just because he's sort of like the perfect example of a studio contract director who shows the fact that to be successful in the studio system, you had to be a jack of all trades when it came to the kind of movies you handled, because he was, because he proved to be just as successful at doing things like The Thin Man as he was at doing operettas with Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald. I mean, and he made them successful because he was efficient and had a good eye and he knew what he was doing. And he was a smart, versatile director. And that's how you succeeded in the studio system.
So you're directing Naughty Marietta, you know, for a couple of weeks, and then you go right into The Thin Man and you've got romantic, corny dialogue, and then you've got The Thin Man dialogue. You've got characters, you got the time. It's like a time warp. Like, you know, how do you adjust to that? And then you go back and do another operetta. But, you know, most of them, and I don't think it was their choice, most of them did a variety of things.
Yeah, but they didn't. But Western, not very many of them did everything well. I mean, it sort of seemed like you could always tell, even with the studio directors, you would find that some of them really excelled at a particular genre than others. And I mean, they would still get assigned to do a little bit of everything, but you could always tell that they were really good at melodrama or they were really good at comedy. And those were the ones that really shone. And the other ones were not so good, but they were still doing them. But the one area that they really, really took off on was, you know, like screwball comedy or whatever. And that's really, really shone. But I think that Van Dyke is one of those guys who really could juggle a lot of different stuff. And he's completely forgotten. Now, I mean, people just don't really remember. I mean, they remember the movies. They just don't know the name.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. His movies survive, but...
Yeah.
My angel heart on my star, the path.
an angel. I'm sure that the change will be awfully good for me. Have you heard? An angel I married. To heaven she's carried this fellow with a kiss. She is sweet and gentle, so it isn't strange when I'm sentimental. She loves me like an angel. Now you've heard, I married an angel. This beautiful change will be awfully good for me. There's been a change in me, and life's as sweet as it can be. I've lots of courage and ambition. From every care my life is free. So I repeat with your permission, there's been a change in me.
Have you heard? Oh, I married an angel. No halo, half or wings. But she has all their things.
Can she cook an omelette?
Can she run out of hay?
When he wants an omelette, I love him.
You want to move on to someone else?
Yeah, I do. I want to move on to 20th Century Fox. Mm-hmm. And I want to move on to Irving Cummings because I know he was at Fox for a very long time. He was at Fox, I think he was at Fox before they were even 20th Century Fox.
Before they merged.
Before they merged because he was
Fox all the way up until 31, I think.
Something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he actually had started as an actor and then switched to directing way back in the silent era. Worked for like 40 years in the business, but the nice thing is his best stuff, I think, at Fox were his musicals. I mean, that's his most memorable stuff were his musicals. And he transitioned from, like I said earlier, in the 30s, Fox was really hitting the jackpot with their Shirley Temple musicals, because she was like gangbusters at the box office. She was number one at the box office for many years. Mm-hmm. And he was handling some of those movies. And then into the 40s, he switched to the fantastic Technicolor Fox musicals that we all know and love with, as I said, Betty Grable and Alice Faye and Don Ameche and Cesar Romero and Carmen Miranda. And almost all of them were set south of the border, which was just like became their sort of their theme was everything had to be set in Latin America somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that was, that wasn't a mistake. Coincidence. There was a big push during the war to involve South America, Latin America, in everything, trade, movies, music, because they couldn't go to Europe,
No longer
were you sending your movies to Germany. The Good Neighbor Policy, remember, as FDR called it, and it was sad because it was a good neighbor as long as we needed them. And then when things went back, they ignored South America. But during this time, not only did they do it for practical reasons, but the audiences loved it. They loved the music.
Uh-huh.
They weren't familiar with, you know, the bossa nova or the this or the that, mm-hmm. the conga. They loved the whole colorful mystique of it. These movies were not realistic by any means.
No. Because they were filmed fully on the 20th Century Fox lot.
Oh, yeah. They never went.
They're clearly filmed on a soundstage. I mean, it's like there's no pretense that they're actually here in Los Angeles.
South American characters, you know, Latin characters were played by white actors.
Yeah.
This was hardly a documentary on the south of the border. But, the audiences loved it, and nobody jumped on that bandwagon more than 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
They had the two great blondes, mm-hmm. Ella Fay and Betty Grable, and then Carmen Miranda, what category you put her in, she was so unique. You know?
Right. And she was She was a Broadway person.
They found her in a Broadway Review. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But no other studio had a Carmen Miranda.
Right. Right.
It's just like no other studio had a Shirley Temple.
Right.
You know, earlier. So when, you know, these are some of the actors that that kept 20th Century Fox floating was because they were so unique. And mm-hmm. if you want to see Shirley Temple, it was going to be a Fox movie.
Right.
He directed, I think, five of hers.
Animal crackers in my soup. Monkeys and rabbits with the loop. Gosh, oh, gee, but I have fun. Swallowing animals one by one. In every bowl of soup I see lions and tigers watching me. I make them jump right through Wahoo, those animal crackers in my soup. When I get hold of the big bad wolf, I just push him under the ground. Then I bite him in a million bits and I go pull him right down. When they're inside me where it's dark, I walk around like Noah's Ark. I stuff my tummy like a goop with animal crackers in my soup. Animal crackers in my soup do funny things to me. They make me think my neighborhood is a big menagerie. For instance, there's our janitor. His name is Mr. Klein. And when he hollers at us kids, he reminds me of the lion. The grocer is so big and fat, he has a big mustache. He looks just like Walrus just before he takes a splash. Animal crackers in my soup, monkeys and rabbits loot the loot. Gosh, boogie, but I have fun swallowing animals one by one. In every bowl of soup I see lions and tigers watching me. I make them jump right through a hoop, those animal crackers in my soup. When I get cold on the big bad wolf, I just push him under to brown. Then I bite him in a million bits and I go pull him right down. When they're inside me where it's dark, I walk around like Noah's Ark. I stuff my tummy like a goop with animal crackers in my soup.
It must have been important in a Shirley Temple movie that there be some kind of consistency in one to the other, that she wasn't getting, you know, she had to some of the same actors, but I think it probably was good for her to see, oh, good. You know, Irving, I don't know what they call him. Irv is going to be directing this one again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they knew that that kind of consistency is going to make her more secure, although she was not an insecure kid. Mm-hmm. And she's going to be more comfortable, mm-hmm. and you're going to know her, and you're going to know the language, and you know how to communicate with her, and she's going to understand you, and you'll get a faster and better movie because of it. Other people, the director, but I think Irving Cummings is the one that she's probably most comfortable with and the one that she worked with the most. He worked with a lot of great actors, as you mentioned, you know, somebody who could work with the temperament of a child star and then a Cesar Romero, you know, or, you know, he must have been a really good communicator and his interpersonal skills must have been pretty good. You know, to work with these different people and get wonderful performances out of them.
Right.
But, you know, because he made so many movies, we think he made about 70 movies, and there's a, his musicals looks like there's about a dozen or so. He also went, you know, from here to there to there. You know, I'm sure he directed anything that they, you know, told him to do at Fox. But the musicals were kind of special, and I think he must have been one of their, you know, favorites.
Right.
Yeah. In that category.
Yeah. I think when you look at the, when you look at the history of the musicals at Fox, they tended to stick the same way with their actors. They tended to pigeonhole their actors and their directors and stuff into specific slots. And if you were a Alice Faye or a Don Ameche or whatever, you did get occasionally got to stray a little bit from the musical genre, but when they were putting together a musical, it was, this is the director, this is the stars, this is how it's going to look, and it was a package deal because because that's what audiences were clamoring for. They wanted to see the next Alice Faye Don Ameche movie, and they wanted to, and it was going to be directed by
Irving
Cummings.
They wanted to see them together.
Yeah, and they it was going to be Irving Cummings helming behind the camera, and it was going to be, you know, the sets were going to look like this, and the costumes were going to be, and it was going to be set in Latin America. It was going to be, and it was just, it was a formula, and that included the director as part of the package. I mean, it just sort of seemed, it was sort of like you said with the Shirley Temple things. You had the comfort level of, we have Shirley Temple, she's a big star. We have Irving Cummings is the best person to shepherd her through these movies, so we're going to keep assigning her. Not that different than what we just talked about with Van Dyke at MGM. Once he settled in with Jeanette MacDonald, it became natural for them to reassign him. Work with Jeanette MacDonald. So it was sort of the same with Cummings. And it's interesting because people, again, remember the movies. Yes. They remember the Shirley Temple movies, obviously. And they remember that there has been a real resurgence in interest of the 1940s Fox musicals because they are silly, but they're fun. And the Technicolor, as you said, is totally different than the Technicolor being used at the other studios. It looks totally different. The colors that they're using are totally different. They have a very unique style to them, and they've become back in favor. I think people take a look at them, and they know the movies, and they know the stars, but a lot of them don't know the directors.
No.
Meu ganso afastica, tica bum tica, pra eu cantar no tica tica bum tica, com a canção do tica tica bum tica. Meu coração faz tica tica bum tica, e vem a saudade da Bahia, onde o samba tem canjere também numa batucada. Tic tic bum, tic 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 bum, tic tic bum, tic 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 bum. É brasileiro, tica tica bum tica, com um pandeiro fazendo tica bum tica. E para terminar, um tica tica bum, vocês devem cantar o tica tica bum, tica tica bum, tica tica bum, tica tica bum tica. Thank you. boom, 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 chicky, boom, 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 boom. It don't make sense to chicka chicka boom chick, but it's a mess to chicka chicka boom, achi, 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 boom. That's all you've got to say. Do chase the jeans away. Chicka chicka boom, chicka chicka boom, chicka chicka boom, chicka chicka boom, 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 boom.
Even those of us who love movies will go to a particular favorite movie, we'll have to stop and go, oh, who directed that?
Yeah.
It doesn't jump at you like, oh, yeah, you know.
Right.
Judy Garland's in that and Fred Astaire and blah, blah, blah. Oh, who directed that one? Mm-hmm. Because unless it's like really obvious. You
know, right. It's easier. It's funny because it's what, as we talked at the beginning of the show, if they all have a certain look, because I can, you know, I can turn on Turner Classic Movies and just like turn it on and I can hop right into the middle of a movie and I can watch 2 minutes of it at the most and I can say, oh, this is an RKO film. This is a Columbia film. This is a Paramount film. And I can guess sort of it range year-wise approximately what year it is because it has a certain look.
Oh,
the scenic design has a certain look. It just has a certain feel and you can tell what studio it is. Mm-hmm. But you can't always, and you can see the stars and you know who was under contract where, but you don't always know who the director is because it could be anybody.
It doesn't jump out at
unless
you
know the movie and you know specifically who the director is. You just don't know. So that's why this book is so valuable, I think, is because it really is shining a spotlight on the directors behind these musicals that people don't remember. Mm-hmm. So I want to now move on to someone who I think is the epitome of what we also talked about at the beginning of the kind of the Broadway to Hollywood pipeline.
Oh, yeah.
Because he really is one of those people who started in New York on Broadway and moved through the pipeline to Hollywood, became a very successful choreographer in Hollywood very quickly. And then very quickly, just by chance, moved into the director's chair and became and worked his way right through to the end of the golden age of the Hollywood
musical. Yeah, he's coming in a little later than
He does come in a little bit later, but that's because he started on Broadway as a dancer. And that is Charles Walters.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about Charles Walters and his lengthy, very interesting career from New York all the way to Hollywood.
And you didn't mention, he came back to Broadway on several occasions.
Yeah.
I saw him on Broadway in the 1980s, I think, in La Cage aux Folles. He was one of the replacements.
Oh, right.
Yeah. He was still performing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he did some revivals in New York and do classic. So, he was a true theater movie. Yeah, he really did. He was very successful on Broadway as a young age. I mean, he's choreographing musicals when he's just in his early 20s. Mm-hmm. And these are major Broadway musicals. So, of course, Hollywood is always on the lookout. You know, they're always watching Broadway for what is. And first he dances, but then he moves into choreography and they see his choreography and they're looking all the time. And MGM, who did so many musicals and had so many choreographers, they're the ones I think that that got him. And he must have choreographed a dozen movies, you know, some that had a lot of dancing, some that didn't. And then they let him make the next step. They didn't like that. They fought choreographers moving into directors. They thought your choreographer is a choreographer, and that's what you do, and you should do that. And you're not you're getting out of the category here. They fought Busby Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Made so many movies, and before they'd finally say, "Okay, you can direct the next one,"
But Charles Walters, I mean, when he first came, he came to work with the Arthur Freed unit at MGM, which was doing the big musicals.
And he
choreographed like Meet Me in St. Louis and Harvey Girls and Girl Crazy. So he was choreographing some big, these were A pictures. that he was
performing.
And it was sort of like, then he finally gets his first director's gig with Good News.
Mm-hmm. And that came about because somebody dropped out. I forget what happened. I think he was going to be the choreographer, and then it was like the director couldn't do it, and they said, well, let's let him do it, if I'm sure.
Right. Right.
And that movie is very well directed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is a corny college movie that was kind of spiced up a little bit. Condiment Green redid the script. It's an old Broadway a musical, and a lot of his things were. And they kind of took the old story and changed it a little bit. Wonderful songs that existed already, added a few more. And it was a big production for his first movie. This was it had several characters, speaking characters. It wasn't a simple one. And it had several dance sequences that were, you know, they had to be, if not choreographed, they had to be well filmed.
Mm-hmm.
And how he filmed title song, Good News, or Pass That Peace Pipe, they were really well filmed, you know. He was very, very good at it.
A medicine man I met said, don't get yourself in a sweat. When things look gray, just shrug and say, it must have been something I ate. So don't get yourself in a snit, he said. Tuck your tantrums into your kit instead. It's disarming to be charming, quoth the medicine man, whom all agree it's plain to see nobody could wiser than. So with your tempers getting the top hand, all you have to do is just stop and pass that peace pipe and bury that hatchet like the chump goes strip was due. If you're feeling mad as a wet hen, mad as you can possibly get, then pass that peace pipe and bury that tomahawk like those Chichum X, Cherokee, Chipotle X too. All of that war pain. But if you wanna be an all right guy, not a long face who's a night guy, write that apology and dispatch it when you call his friend a patchet. Pass that peace pipe and bury that hatchet like the top draws, Chickasaws, Chattahoochee, Chippewas, and those Chichimex, Cherokees, Chipotlepec, and those Chicoutimis, Chepachets, and Chickasees, Chocos, Tangos, Chattanoogas, Chicharos.
Thank you.
after he got known as a director, he didn't choreograph all the time, but he, you know, but his movies had a feel to them. Mm-hmm. They very, you know, and again, nobody knows his name, but they sure as heck know Easter Parade,
right?
Summerstock, you know, Lily,
Barclays of Broadway.
Yeah, Barclays of High Society. Mm-hmm. And these are all A movies with superstars.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them giving outstanding performances. Some mm-hmm. of the best performance. Judy Garland, I think some of her best stuff was Easter Parade, mm-hmm. Summerstock, even though she was not at her best there. It's interesting, in 1953, he directed four musicals, four big musicals, but that's how they did it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I also love that he got, like we mentioned before, with, you know, W.S. Van Dyke getting assigned to Jeanette McDonald, mm-hmm. and Irving Cummings shepherding Shirley Temple. Mm-hmm. Charles Walters also was not immune to getting assigned to shepherd a newbie. In this case, he got Esther Williams.
Yes. Her first movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he ended up doing four.
What do you do with a swimming star?
Yeah, he did like several of her films.
Yeah.
Which was interesting.
But he's the one that did her very first time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think his relationship with Judy Garland goes back, because he's choreographing.
Meet Me in St. Louis at Harvey Girls.
And so he moves into director. And he gets wonderful performances out of her.
Well, I think also, because you tell the story in the book, I recall when he got, because Easter Parade is sort of like the big bump up for him, because he'd done Good News, which didn't have any huge stars in it.
Mm-hmm.
But Easter Parade was a big jump up, because it's now Fred Astaire and Judy Garland.
Right.
And it was supposed to be Vincent Minnelli directing, but because there was some issues between,
They were married,
and there were some issues. There was a recommendation that they not work together.
Yeah, she was in therapy.
The therapist said,
you're having trouble. I don't think you should be, forced to be together all day. And so I don't think Minnelli fought about it.
Right.
I don't know if it was a particular pet project of his or not, but so that's how Charles Walters got it.
Saw you look quite so pretty before. Never saw you dress quite so handsome. What's more, I could hardly wait to keep our date this lovely Easter morning. And my heart beat fast as I came through the door. In the Easter parade, I'll be all in clover, and when they look us over, we'll be the proudest couple in the Easter parade. On the Avenue, Fifth Avenue, photographers will snap us, and you find that you're in the rotogravure. Oh, I could write a sonnet about your Easter bonnet and of the guy I'm taking to the Easter parade.
On the Avenue, Fifth Avenue, the photographers will snap us, and you'll find that you're in the rotogravure.
I could write a sonnet about your Easter parade, and take you to the Easter parade.
Easter Parade, it's got a better script than a lot of those musicals. It really does have a good script. It gives Ann Miller a wonderful character, probably her best performance. And it gave Fred Astaire a new lease on life because he was going to retire.
Right.
Out of the picture. I shouldn't say that picture, but out of the Hollywood picture. And he thought he was getting too old for his co-stars, you know. They went to him and they asked him, he said, no, I'm really finished. And they he said, well, Judy Garland's going to be in it. And he had never worked with her.
Right.
Different studios and whatnot. He wanted to work with her. So that's the only reason he came out of semi-retirement. Mm-hmm. And because Easter Parade was such a hit, he said, the hell with the retirement, did another 10 years.
Yeah.
And the trouble is, he got older and he got younger and it looked a little, get to Daddy Longlegs or poor Fred Astaire looked like the girl's grandfather instead of sweetheart. But everybody loved Fred Astaire and they weren't going to, you know, do it. I Love in Royal Wedding, which Walters did not direct, but a royal wedding that he got to play brother's sister was to Jane Powell. And it was like, now that's more believable.
But Charles Walters Charles Walters kind of, because he went all the way through to like Unsinkable Molly Brown even.
Oh, yeah.
Which is early 60s.
Yeah.
So
The golden age is finished. Yeah. Hollywood is still trying to make, and this is a big one because it's based on a Broadway hit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was Tammy Grimes on Broadway, but it was the new star, Debbie Reynolds, who is interesting because she comes in at the end of the golden age and then she keeps working, but they're not making the movies like they used to. He did Jumbo. Doris Day, you know, and that was 62, and it just, the era is over with, you know.
Right.
And he is responsible partially for Gigi. I have to mention that because it was filmed in Paris, and then they did some Hollywood scenes, and then Vince Minnelli went off to direct a play in London. I think it was The Reluctant Debutante, and he's gone. And Lerner and Lowe, the studio's going to release it. And it has a terrible pre-audience test showing. The cards are not good. And the studio says, well, we've spent so much on this because Minnelli went over budget. And let's just release it and we'll just write it off as, you know. And Lerner and Lowe said, this could be fixed. It's only a few things. And they said, we're not spending any more money on this. And Lerner and Lowe, they were very stubborn and smart. And Lerner said, I'll buy it from you. I will buy the entire movie. It'll be mine. I'm going to fix it and I'm going to release it. He didn't have the money, but, he could have gotten it. In the studio, you know, this is the way the studio thinks, oh, if he's willing to do that, maybe we're, you know. So they gave him some money. I think they only had about 11 days of refilming. Charles Walters was the one brought in and directed some of those most famous scenes. The scene in the, it's the famous restaurant, Maxime's. He directed that, redirected that scene because it didn't work in the original. He directed the scene with Marie Chevalier and Hermione Gingold singing I Remember It Well and a couple of other things. And it fixed it. It really did. And that movie opened with great, you know, reviews. And it was Walters who, you know, he's I don't think he's credited, but everybody knew he did it. And that's a totally different movie than he was, you know, used to. Yeah. So he was a pretty good, but he never gave up performing. He always wanted to go back on the stage. And he did on occasion. And he retired in 66. He worked all the way to 66, not in musicals, but in other things. And then lived another 20 years doing some theater. Yeah, when I saw him.
Yeah, he's one of the really more amazing characters in the book. So
we talk about one of his movies, I think, is not as well known, but as I think is amazing, is Lily.
Yeah.
Lily, which is barely a musical, it's only got a song or two, a lot of dance. I think it's a unique movie because it doesn't look like a Hollywood movie. It looks like a foreign film.
Mm-hmm.
Something about it. I can't put my finger on it, but all the actors are foreign and mostly. And something about the way it's filmed and its sense of, I don't know, it's that French thing that's not real, you know, but real enough. And I think it's a remarkable movie. It was popular.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not as well known today. It's not one that, you know, people, you know, dig out like Singing in the Rain or something.
Right.
And but I think it's and it's him. It's Charles Walters, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He must have just loved the opportunity to say, wow, this is not realism.
Right.
You know, the ballet that he does, and it is not like the, you know, American
right.
Paris ballet. It's a very European ballet kind of thing. Remarkable movie, really. Mm-hmm. And they turned it into the Broadway show.
Carnival. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But,
yeah, it became Carnival.
They didn't take the main song.
Right.
And they did a whole new score, which was very good. Mm-hmm. And Carnival was a hit. But I don't think Lily's as well known as it should be. I you know, some people wouldn't like it because it's not American.
It's got a very European feel to it.
Yeah. Even more than Gigi, you know.
Yeah, oh definitely. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gigi feels like a Hollywood version of a French
Paris.
And, Paris. Yeah, it does.
It feels like a poster.
It feels like it was made by a big Hollywood studio.
Yeah.
And Lily doesn't. Lily feels like it could have been made by a big European studio.
Yes.
It really does.
Small budget.
Yeah.
You know, and, but anyway, that to me shows the talents of Charles Walters is much more than you just might assume. He really is quite good.
On every tree there sits a bird singing a song of love. On every tree there sits a bird, and everyone I ever heard could break my heart without a word, singing a song of love.
A song of love is a sad song. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, lo. A song of love is a song of woe. Don't ask me how I know. A song of love is a sad song. Oh, I have loved and it so. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, lo, hi, lo. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, lo. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, lo, hi, lo. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, lo. A song of love is a sad song. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, lo. A song of love is a song of woe. Don't ask me how I know. A song of love is a sad song. For I have loved it so. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, lo, hi, lo. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, lo. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, lo, hi, lo. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, lo.
Well, we are almost out of time, but hopefully we have whet your appetite, dear listeners, to check out the Tom's new book, Bringing Song and Dance to the Screen, Directors of Golden Age Hollywood Musicals, which is out now from Bloomsbury. I highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you.
It's not only fun if you are a fan of musicals, but just also if you're a fan of Hollywood, classic Hollywood films, because he tells a lot of biographical and interesting tidbits about each of the directors, mm-hmm. as well as examining the films, the musical films that they directed. Kind of brings it back to, as I said, shines a spotlight on the guys behind the camera who directed some of these wonderful musicals that you've heard of, but you probably don't remember who was behind the camera, who was sitting in that director's chair. So it's important to kind of remember who these guys were and where they came from. So Tom, I really appreciate it. It's wonderful. And I assume have you started working on another book yet?
Oh, yeah.
such enthusiasm.
I finished a movie book called about movie songs, similar to the theater book.
Uh-huh.
But right now we're just talking early stages. I really want to write a book about Lerner and Lowe.
Oh, uh-huh.
Biography, but a real critical look at their careers. It hasn't been covered well enough, just the biographies. And so that's what we're looking at right now.
Oh, cool.
Something to do with Lerner and Lowe. Yeah.
Terrific. Well, congratulations on this book. I highly recommend it. And where would you like people to go to purchase this particular book?
Bloomsbury and Amazon. You
know? Okay.
Yeah. I think it's the same price. I could be wrong. Amazon might be a little cheaper, but I don't think so.
I will check it out, and I will post on the radio show website the better of the two links to direct listeners to the place to go to pick up the book. Again, I highly recommend it. And Tom, it's always wonderful to have you here.
Hey, thank you.